Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast. Brought to you by the ANU National Security College, with support from policyforum.net. In this episode, Felicity Miller, policy advisor here at the college, investigates a number of key policy issues with four experts in the lead up to the 2022 federal election. Before we get into it, we'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal people, traditional owners of the land from which we broadcast. We pay our respects to their elders past, present, and emerging.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast. I'm Felicity Miller. With the 2022 election fast approaching, there's no better time to assess the range of national security policies on offer to the electorate. In this episode, we're exploring policies put forward in defence, domestic security, international partnerships, and disaster resilience with four expert commentators. They'll help us identify areas of bipartisanship, note differences where they exist, and highlight areas of potential minor party and independent influence in national security policymaking. If you'd like more information on these policies, check out our detailed national security election snapshots. Links are in the show notes. A quick reminder that the NSC is independent in its activities, research, and editorial judgment, and does not take institutional or partisan positions on policy issues. The opinions offered are solely the views of our guests. Let's get into it. Australia is facing a deteriorating strategic environment, with both domestic and international threats to contend with. China's assertiveness in our region and Russia's invasion of Ukraine highlight the challenges ahead. To discuss the differing views towards defence spending, Dr. Andrew Carr, Senior Lecturer of the ANU Strategic and Defence Studies Centre, joins me. Andrew, let's start off with the policy of a new defence posture review. Why has Labor committed to one if successful in the 2022 federal election? And is this something the coalition should have considered?
So there's probably a couple of reasons behind Labor's decision here. On the policy side, the 2020 Defence Strategic Update really called time on the old way that we thought about Australian defence. It said, we're in a new era, things have radically changed, and we need to change with it. Yet the purpose of that document is to say, here's what's going on in the world, and here's what we're spending money on in response. What's missing is that kind of strategic bit in the middle that says, well, what can the ADF exactly do now with the capability it has, and what do we need it to do, and how sure are we that it can actually achieve what we need it to achieve? So this is a question that defence looks at every day. They're always looking at it, but a large, rigorous review from time to time is a useful step. So I think policy-wise, there's value in it. And for the political side, I think it's useful for Labor as a sign that we're engaged, we're interested in the portfolio. When we come to office, things like this review can be really useful for learning about a portfolio and getting to understand what the capabilities of the new government are going to have under their belt with the ADF. But it also just kind of shows that they're interested, despite their normal kind of, it's all bipartisan, we're just going to stand alongside the government. This is a way to kind of stand aside from them a little bit, but without challenging core policy issues.
Has there been a shift in the rhetoric recently around national security and defence spending?
Yeah, it's a really key question at the moment, because I think the landscape is shifting on both the value of bipartisanship, but also about how much we spend. Just looking at the spending side, you know, the conversation has already moved far beyond 2% of GDP. I think that's one of the problems with having our defence spending tied to a somewhat arbitrary round number. Having, you know, your GDP does not equal to your security in the world. You don't buy necessarily a lot more security if you have just a bit more spending as a GDP term. It's all about what you can actually do with that spending that really matters. And so this is one of the problems with the 2% number. It doesn't say, well, where do you go next? I do think the conversation is starting to change around the value of those kind of issues. And one of the key parts of this will be what the public is willing to accept. The Australian government can afford 2%, probably up to 3%, by just moving things around, delaying certain things, taking money off the sides. If we want to go really above that, which some of the predictions are, we're going to have to start saying, well, we can't have the tax cuts, or we have to change our policy with the NDIS or schools or education. And I'm not sure the public is yet willing to support such an explicit trade-off, or the politicians are really going to be willing to risk a lot of votes by saying we need to make that trade-off explicit.
The current coalition government has increased defence spending to more than 2% of GDP. Do you think there's a broad acceptance among the two major political parties that this is the new normal?
Yeah, so about a decade ago, this idea that we should spend about 2% emerged. It partly emerged from a critique of the Gillard government spending what was seen as kind of 1.56% of GDP, kind of which was a nice little comparison of a lowest number since 1938. Now, I wrote a bit about this at the time with a colleague, and we said, look, this is not actually a good way to think about defence spending. But once the critique of we're spending too low as a percent of GDP emerged, very soon after the conversation became, well, what the right number is 2%. So we've kind of jumped somewhat arbitrarily towards 2%. It's roughly in line with where NATO and some other kind of international debates are, but it's just not a useful barometer of our security. In fact, the Rudd government came very close to 2% because we were in the global financial crisis. So our economy shrunk, which made our defence spending look a lot better. But I think we're seeing the conversation start to say, okay, we need to spend more on particular kinds of equipment and budget around that amount.
The Greens propose that Australia's defence spending should be cut to 1.5% of GDP. What impact do you think this would have on Australia's national security?
So if we immediately cut back to 1.5%, I think in the short term, it would be quite negligible effect. Longer term, you might see more significant issues, particularly as it affected our ability to be involved with the ANZUS alliance and the way that that relationship played out, the American sense of our commitment to them and what we could do. But there are ways that you could design the defence budget that would probably achieve about the same level of security as we have now, just on 1.5%. You know, you could put a lot more into diplomacy, into aid, into kind of strengthening our regional relationships, and perhaps a lot more into things such as long-range missiles for deterrence purposes. And that's a legitimate posture. In some ways, the Greens policy would make Australia a bit more like our neighbours in Asia, and that is capable within our very immediate region, but not able to send forces overseas and just accepting a higher level of risk that we don't think war is going to come to our shores and we're going to devote our money elsewhere. And that's a perfectly legitimate approach. I think that that's a fine one. My problem with some of the Greens' discussions about this is they almost approach it like an issue of domestic politics. You know, in domestic politics, you can kind of say, here are our priorities, here's what we're spending. You know, we want to do more on preschoolers reading or retraining, you know, the middle age to get back into the workforce. And you can set your priorities. But when it comes to foreign policy, it's more about the world will ask you questions and you have to answer them. And you have to be able to say, here are the risks we're going to take on by accepting these trade-offs. And I think the Greens, if they want to build support for it, really need to start to say, here are those trade-offs, here are the risks we're willing to accept. And I think there's a case they can make for it, but we're yet to see really that effort to do so.
Geographically, how tightly focused should our defence spending be?
So this is one of the kind of great untold stories in some ways of the last several years. For all of our rhetoric about global issues and Ukraine and the Indo-Pacific, if you read the 2016 White Paper and the 2020 Defence Strategic Update, they start pulling our horizons quite considerably in. So 2016 was about Indo-Pacific and really even dividing within that. There was an inner and an outer region that mattered. And the 2020 Defence Strategic Update, it doesn't trumpet this, but it says very explicitly, the purpose of the ADF, the design and focus, what we're spending our money on, is to be able to operate in our immediate region. So it's a very tight focus. And that's a little bit into the Indian Ocean, it's the South Pacific, and it's maritime Southeast Asia. So very quite tight geographic focus. We've pulled our horizons in because we're worried about the threats that are starting to emerge. So there is already a quite significant reallocation towards our region. The challenge at times is, you know, the ball is bouncing of international affairs and we sometimes follow that. And I think our time of our leaders will be almost as important as the money we spend in, you know, can we address these issues? You know, the Pacific feels rightly that we haven't approached them in the right way. We're not listening. We're not investing the time with them. The money comes along. The money is important, but it's also about our own kind of direct commitment to it. And I think that needs to be made a little bit more explicit rather than left implicit in some of these documents.
We've recently seen $9.9 billion earmarked for ASD as a part of the Red Spice project. What's your view on the role of intelligence within defence and in the context of this election?
Yeah, it's an interesting shift. And you know, just anecdotally, when I first started teaching on foreign policy, I remember asking the students, you know, what do you want to go into for your career? And 80, 90% said DFAT. And a few wanted defence. And now a third to a half are saying an intelligence career. So I think there's been a real shift in the perception of the role of the different parts of government that contribute to national security. And it's great to see the intelligence kind of really being beefed up. An argument that I'm hearing out of quite a number in the military establishment is they also want to see a lot more of the diplomatic and aid elements beefed up as well. That, you know, as particularly in a region like the South Pacific, but also true in Southeast Asia, it's as much about our ability to be there and contribute to the problems they're trying to solve today that is probably more important than some of these, you know, long-term 20 or 30-year big capabilities in terms of the kinds of relationships that we're really focused on. And, you know, I remember a former chief of army kind of saying, you know, he wants a lot of spending on aid so that the ADF are the last people who ever have to go into a place and not the first, as often kind of seems to be the way. And, you know, if you think about the challenges of climate change, we've got another significant challenge with the ADF often being kind of tasked to go out. So I think it's great to see intelligence getting more focus because a lot of what's going on really is about trying to decipher, you know, what are the big patterns and how do they apply? We need big public debates to try and work these things out. So that's why I think it's actually great that independents are starting to talk about defence issues, the Greens are starting to talk about defence issues. You know, we're a democratic system, and I think the strength of our system is we can kind of feed all of this into it and say, well, what is the world actually asking us? You know, how do we respond to these big challenges? It shouldn't just be left to people like me to try and make these decisions because we're going to get it wrong as much as anyone.
Like defence spending, international partnerships are a highly contested policy domain. There are many competing views about how Australia should or shouldn't interact with its partners. In particular, the new AUKUS agreement with the United Kingdom and the United States and Australia's involvement in the Quad have their fair share of critics and proponents. Hayley Channer from the Perth US Asia Centre joins me to unpack the differing views of Australia's approach to international partnerships in this election. To start off with, what should be the highest priority of the incoming government, new or returned, in foreign affairs and defence in the first year?
Yeah, great question, and something that I've been asking myself for quite a while now because it has felt like the election has gone on forever and ever. So there are a couple of priorities I'd love to see a new or returned government focus on. The first one will come as no surprise to your listeners. It's China. The reason China is the highest order of priority is because it affects our economy and our security. And I think in the lead up to the election, there's been a lot of very harsh rhetoric around China. And what we need to do after the election is to really tamp down on that and start a new process where we can press reset on that China button so that we can focus on the relationship for years going forward. The other thing I would really love to see a new government do is actually modernize the Australia-US alliance. So the alliance is 70 years old. It's very old. And 70 years ago, the situation was completely different to what it is now. And what I mean by modernise is a lot of the alliance seems to focus on hard conventional security issues. And yes, we've seen a return to those issues with the Ukraine. But I think what needs to happen going forward is to convince, you know, upcoming generations about the value of the alliance. They really need to focus on things that are new security challenges like climate change, non-traditional challenges to bring the alliance into, you know, the 21st century. The other thing I'd really like to see is probably a new defence white paper and a new foreign policy white paper. The last that we had were for defence was back in 2016. I was actually in the defence minister's office at the time it was delivered. And, you know, that's quite a long time ago now. The situation has moved on. Similarly, for the foreign policy white paper, that was in 2017. And what I would like to see from that is a new focus on how quickly the Indo-Pacific region has changed and Australia's priorities and our strategic messaging around the region needs to have a bit of a refresh so that countries in our region know exactly what we're thinking and where we're headed with our foreign policy engagement. So I think, new white papers in those two areas would be really important.
The Solomon Islands-China Security Agreement is one of the examples of the changing Indo-Pacific region that you mentioned. What challenges does it present for the incoming government?
Obviously, Australia has been focused on the Pacific for decades and, you know, ever since the Pacific Step Up a few years back, it has been refocusing on that region. I don't think that Australia dropped the ball or anything in terms of the China-Solomon Islands deal. The Solomon Islands is a sovereign nation and it can make its own decisions about who it wants to partner with. And obviously, the violent riots that happened in the Solomon Islands last November has been a kind of catalyst for or, you know, foundation for this agreement to happen. But, you know, it does also remind Australia that there are other major powers like China that have interests in our region and might be kind of encroaching on our traditional leadership role in the Pacific. So I wouldn't say that, you know, Australia's done anything wrong or that it needs to do something differently, except for the fact that it needs to think in new ways about how to engage the Pacific in ways that aren't transactional and also genuine partnership ways. So, for example, if you take the Pacific Islands Forum, there are a few declarations within that forum that Australia has signed, but it hasn't actually acted on. And another issue, which is major for the Pacific, is climate change. If Australia took some action, more dedicated either domestic action or it's in its foreign affairs on climate change, it would gain a lot more credibility within the Pacific and probably endear itself more to Pacific Island countries. So I think that would be really important for the next government.
How has the establishment of AUKUS and the Quad impacted Australia's national security? How would you see these arrangements continuing or evolving if there were a change in government?
I mean, I personally was shocked when I heard about AUKUS last September. I had a lot of, you know, I had a WhatsApp chat with a few of my former defence colleagues and we were all wildly speculating about what the agreement could possibly be. Someone said, oh, you know, they're going to recognise that aliens are real. I was really pleasantly surprised that it was able to be kept under wraps as it was. And at the time, I think Labor had no other option because of the speed of the announcement. No other option but to throw their support behind it when it happened. Luckily for us, though, they have said that they're going to support it and they maintained that stance in the lead up to the election. So in terms of how important AUKUS and the Quad are for Australia's national security, I would frame it in these terms. So AUKUS I see as the hard security element of Australia's defence and the Quad I see as a soft security element. So with AUKUS, for example, it binds us even closer to the United States, but it also re-establishes a link between the United Kingdom and its Indo-Pacific relationships and interests. It's also considering the amount that we're spending on AUKUS and the amount of time to deliver 8 submarines. And while in the meantime, we're also doing things in the emerging defence area like undersea warfare, cyber, hypersonics, et cetera. That commitment in itself demonstrates that Australia is serious about defending its interests and contributing more as an alliance partner to the United States, for example. So it is a message that Australia is taking its defence and security seriously and it knows it needs to invest big time going forward. The Quad, on the other hand, is this soft security element. You know, it's focused on a whole range of issues that are separate from defence. So it's focused on climate change. There's critical technologies. Infrastructure is another one. But the Quad has a lot of other priorities that are more focused on delivering public goods for the region, the other one being the COVID-19 vaccine. So I see both AUKUS and the Quad as forming two sides of a coin to Australia's national security approach. And I'd be very hopeful that any future government would be strongly supportive of both of them. The Quad in particular, because it has so many different areas of focus, it will require a lot of investment in terms of just bureaucratic efforts to create working groups and pursue cooperation with the four Quad countries. I wrote a piece for the Perth US Asia Centre last year, which outlined specifically which priorities of the Quad it should focus on going forward, because at the moment it's got about 12 areas that it's looking at, and that's a really big undertaking. What it really needs to do is narrow down on what its core interests are. I've suggested the core interests could be infrastructure in the region, supply chain security, and also digital communication, because digital comms is extremely important for Pacific and Southeast Asia. I mean, you see any disruption to undersea fiber optic cables and, you know, the communications of that country goes down. So that's what I see coming for Australia in terms of AUKUS and the Quad.
DFAT has experienced cuts to its operational budget and aid funding over like many, many years, while intelligence spending has increased greatly. What is the place of diplomacy and foreign aid in the pursuit of Australia's interests?
Yeah, so you're exactly right, Felicity. There have been cuts to DFAT's budget, and in the last federal budget, we saw that the DFAT budget will continue to shrink. The figures that I saw are that it's going to fall from $1.27 billion this year to closer to $1.15 billion in 2025-26. And these cuts really follow decades of cuts to DFAT's budget, while at the same time we've had an increase in defence and intelligence spending. The increase to defence too is huge with the addition of AUKUS. So we're projected to spend in advance of 2% of GDP on defence, around $48 billion. And some have suggested that with AUKUS, which could cost more than $100 billion, it will increase to 3% of GDP. So we're obviously really investing in defence. And then on the other hand, we're not increasing the diplomacy spend. It is so difficult to explain the value of diplomacy versus defence. It's hard to explain it to my family, actually, just talking to a normal person on the street about the importance of influence. Because with diplomacy, so much of it is behind the scenes, under the radar. You might not actually get the outcome that you want, even if we had extremely good diplomats or trade negotiators acting on our behalf. And so for that reason, it is very difficult to justify to the Australian public, especially in the lead up to the election, why should we spend more on diplomats who are posted overseas? So I would really like to see a new government actually articulate that value better. Recently, I've seen the government really treat DFAT as though it's a service agency, one which just implements the, you know, prime minister's or other minister's policy and is not a policy development agency. I would really like to see that change, because there's so many talented, very experienced and clever people at DFAT to draft policy for government. And I think that's the way that we should be tracking, is that DFAT should be developing the policy. And I'd also like to see more of that from defence. So, yeah, it is a difficult story to tell. Australia's had so many diplomatic success stories, but they often happen gradually, you know, like at a creeping pace. So, you know, where on the defence space you see exactly the impact, whether it's a targeted military deployment to a Pacific Island country, for example. With diplomacy, it might be something that takes decades or longer to achieve. I, for instance, worked within defence, within the team that negotiated Australia's status of forces arrangement with Japan, the reciprocal access agreement. And that, you know, took the better half of a decade to negotiate. And when it was announced, it was a real diplomatic achievement, even though it was for a defence agreement. But it wasn't announced with much fanfare. It, you know, was announced in January this year, and few people have heard about it since, because it was that first week of January after everyone's come back from the Christmas and New Year break. So we don't really celebrate enough some of our diplomatic achievements. And, you know, Australia can be really, really credited for so many things, like, for example, the multilateral architecture of the Indo-Pacific region. We are integral to APEC and a lot of other agreements and, you know, trade negotiations, for example. So it is a complicated story to tell. It's not necessarily a really big news-grabby item that the media can latch on to and really champion the achievements of our diplomats. But government needs to recognise the value of diplomats, and they need to do that by allowing that department to develop policy.
The government has been criticised in some areas for being too focused on some exclusive groupings instead of having a deeper engagement with Asia. Do you see this changing after the election? What are the opportunities and challenges in engaging in a wider range of Asian partners?
Yeah, you're right. There's been an explosion of small exclusive groupings, including AUKUS and the reemergence of the Quad. In fact, in the last 10 years alone, we've just seen a number of new small groupings emerge that Australia has been pushing for. So there's been groups like Australia, Japan, India, Australia, Indonesia, Timor-Leste, so a lot of trilaterals. And yes, we've seen groups like the Quad and AUKUS. The government does need to be focused on security, and part of its way to achieve that has been to establish small like-minded groups that are break-offs from larger multilateral groups like the East Asia Summit or ARF or APEC, for example, so that it can prosecute some of these other issue areas in a more targeted way. Because when you have a smaller number of actors in the mix, it's sometimes easier to form a consensus. Sometimes also you can leverage the individual strengths of those members, and you can also at times come to a faster resolution to whatever issue it is. So, for example, the Quad and COVID vaccines, each of the Quad nations are forming a particular piece of the puzzle to deliver a billion COVID vaccines to the region, with the US pharmaceutical companies providing help to India. India's going to manufacture them. Japan's going to help fund it. And then Australia's actually going to deliver the vaccines to the region. So in that one example, you can see how a smaller minilateral grouping can deliver on something in a sort of targeted way, which leverages the strengths of the individual members. But I don't really see Australia's movement towards AUKUS and the Quad as being at the expense of its broader engagement with Asia. It doesn't need to be at the expense of that. It's just that the government has been focused on these smaller mechanisms as being a more effective way to generate activity when some of the larger bodies have been a bit sluggish. So what I would like to see is the government, which it has been doing, refocusing on Southeast Asia and the Pacific. So the refocus, for example, last year the government held its inaugural ASEAN-Australia summit and also became a comprehensive strategic partner of ASEAN. So you can see the government is looking at Southeast Asia and trying to engage with it in new and deeper ways. It's just that, like what I was talking about before, about the impact of diplomacy versus defence, sometimes those changes are under the radar and they're very incremental. I mean, obviously for the last year, we also had to do everything online with COVID. So a lot of these summits happened virtually and Australia can't actually develop the relationships at the person-to-person level that it would normally do on the sidelines of some of these meetings. But it is happening and, you know, Australia needs to keep tracking in that direction because it has spent a lot of diplomatic energy and resources in cultivating and maintaining huge relationships like its one with the United States and also China. And less attention and resources have been put towards countries that are considered not as integral for our interests. But I think that has been short-sighted, and going forward, we do need to have a more even layering of resources to different relationships, more focused directly on our region, though. I personally believe that we should be pulling back from areas like Europe and focusing more specifically on the Indo-Pacific, mainly because of our resourcing. If you look at the resources that we have at our disposal diplomatically, I think it would be better spent in a more condensed way in our immediate region than it would be spread so thinly across the globe. And in terms of the incoming or, you know, government or a returned government, for example, the Labor Party historically has been more focused on large multilateral groups like the United Nations, whereas over the last 9 years, the coalition has been, you know, showing a tendency towards smaller groups specifically focused on the Indo-Pacific. So who knows what will happen after the election, but whatever happens, I think we need to be focused on looking after and tending our relations with Southeast Asia and the Pacific more so than we haven't done in the past.
We'll be right back.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists, and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
Domestic security has recently been brought into the spotlight due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Australia has experienced a rise in social division, fueled in part by state-based border closures, lockdowns, and economic turbulence. Foreign interference, particularly in the cyber domain, is also of growing concern in this election. Dr. Daniel Ireland-Piper from Bond University joins me. To start off with, Australia's experience of the pandemic has exposed cracks in our social cohesion, and we've also witnessed some really concerning divides in other states, including the United States. How concerned should an incoming government be about the potential rise of domestic political violent extremism?
It's a really interesting question. It's well documented now that there are concerns, increasing concerns amongst the relevant agencies about the rise of political extremism from the far right in Australia. In terms of cracks in our social cohesion, you're absolutely right. We have seen some really concerning divides in other countries. You've mentioned the US. I would say that I do think there are distinct cultural and social differences between the US and Australia. And I think probably the most significant of those is that we have a social welfare net, a safety net in Australia. And whilst, of course, there's still a growing gap socioeconomically, and the housing crisis is certainly coming to the fore in Australia, we don't see those same class disparities necessarily all the time. And I think that is in our favour. Social trust, though, has been eroded in some ways, and trust in government. And we've seen that, for example, during debates on vaccination and lockdown and a lack of social cohesion. And I think we also saw the role federalism can play in this, both in a positive and in a disadvantageous sense, during the management of the pandemic, in the sense that the rise of the state premiers meant that the pandemic was responded to in a localized and, you know, largely appropriate fashion. But we did see a rise in state parochialism, particularly along border areas, in terms of when there were lockdowns and people not able to cross. And I think that's unfortunate because we really need each other in Australia. We're a very large country with a relatively small tax base, a relatively small population. And so our social cohesion really requires us to think as one national identity rather than as parochial separate states. So I think that's something that we're going to have to think about. And I think that goes to questions of national identity, which I'll talk a little bit more about later. I also just wanted to make the point that in terms of trust in government, we did see during the management of the pandemic exercises of unelected power, for example, through public health officers, and extraordinary extensions of non-codified executive power. And I'm not suggesting that that was inappropriate. My view is that most of those exercises were appropriate to the time. But I think we do need to see some winding back and some increasing in accountability in executive decision making if we are to restore social trust and to start to rebuild social cohesion across state borders.
What role can the federal government and the major political parties have in helping to heal and manage these potential social divides? On like the flip side as well, are there any dangers of our politics becoming even more fragmented and divisive?
I think my answer to that question as to what the federal government can do and major political parties can do to help heal and produce social cohesion exists on both a macro and a micro level. So at a micro level, you mentioned interest rates. Housing is a very real concern for people. There's real intergenerational equity issues here. Access to education, digital literacy is a huge thing. If you look in some rural regional areas, for example, where anti-vaccination rates were very high, I'd be very interested to see some data on digital literacy in those communities. We've seen the natural disasters and people feeling let down by government, rightly or wrongly. And so I think there's some really important day-to-day practical micro things that the federal government can do. And I think some more coordinated leadership, going back to that theme of federalism, decentralized power in the states is a wonderful thing. Federalism is a wonderful thing. However, at times of crisis and at times of big picture events, we do need national leadership. And I think that's something the federal government could really step into going forward. And part of that, I think, goes to that question I mentioned earlier about what our national identity is. So if you'll indulge me for a moment, the constitutional lawyer in me has a constitutional solution to this. And that is that a constitution is meant to be the blueprint of a nation. And our constitution actually says so little about us. 44 referendum questions, so referendum questions to change the constitution, have been put to the Australian people since we federated in 1901. Only 8 of those have been answered in the affirmative. So constitutional change is hard to achieve. However, I don't think that should stop us from engaging in questions of constitutional reform, because it is the blueprint of our nation. And so there's a whole lot that we could do in terms of creating a narrative around our national identity. I've actually seen this when I travel in countries where there's been more engagement with the community in constitution making, in the sense of more frequent constitutional change, such as in Ireland, for example. You see greater levels of constitutional literacy and a greater consistent narrative around what it is to be Irish, for example. I think in Australia, we need to have a conversation about what our national blueprint looks like, what it says about who we are. And in so doing, I think we could sort of clarify a little bit these themes of federalism that I've mentioned, particularly in the context of responding to natural disasters, which are going to continue to happen, and in, you know, managing global affairs such as the pandemic that we saw in recent years. And so I think there's some truth telling that needs to happen in our constitution. And there's a bigger conversation about who we are and who we want to be. Just to give you a little example of this, when surveyed probably around 7 years ago, approximately 60% of Australians believed that we had a Bill of Rights in our constitution. But we're actually the only Western democracy that doesn't have a Bill of Rights. And most people find this quite extraordinary. We still have provisions in our constitution that says that the states, if they so choose, can exclude a race from voting. That's quite an extraordinary provision to have in a democracy in the year 2022. And so while that might seem technical and removed and clinical to your average person, having national conversations about who we are and about the document that's going to guide our nation moving forward are still really important conversations to have. And I think the federal government could show some leadership going forward on this, regardless of who wins the next election. In terms of a hung parliament, I'm not convinced it's inherently divisive in and of itself. We have seen some productive hung parliaments before in terms of legislative output. I guess it depends, as you say, which minor parties end up having a voice, so to speak, in parliament. And so it's not inherently divisive in and of itself. But of course, it will be a very interesting time to manage. And I think regardless of how it turns out, it's time for Australia to have a national conversation about who we are, how we're going to care for our people in times of natural disasters, how we're going to care for our people in terms of managing housing and economic equality, and to get a narrative about who we are. And I think that will go a long way to ensuring greater levels of social cohesion in the future.
What do you see as the biggest threats from foreign interference, and how should the next federal government respond to this issue?
Look, there are a risk, and they're a risk for every nation in this current era. That's certainly true. I think we've seen this even in the last few years prior to the election in terms of misinformation around vaccines or misinformation around management of public health measures like lockdowns. So the seeds are already there. We're seeing now reported attempts by certain commentators or certain AI algorithms to change and alter views on the war in Ukraine, for example. But I guess my response to that would be, yes, it's a risk. Yes, it needs to be a priority. But these are questions of A, digital literacy, but also a question of our national conversations and our national identity being led rather than merely responded to. So counter-narratives are difficult to combat if you don't have a solid foundation from which to counter them. So if our national identity is fragmented and not coherent, we don't have a firm base from which to defend. I mean that metaphorically, but in a national security context, I also mean to defend quite literally as well. And so our national conversation about who we are as a country, how we look after our people, who's included, how we remain safe, need to be led through strong national leadership and also through initiatives to improve digital literacy, because online threats and online misinformation and foreign interference is not going to go away overnight, no matter how much attention we pay to it. And therefore, we need strong and robust mechanisms and strong and robust social trust and social cohesion in order to have digitally literate conversations about this issue.
Are we doing enough to protect social cohesion from an increasingly complex and challenging cybersphere?
Well, I mean, I'm sure among your listeners, there's people with greater technical expertise than I on the design of the algorithms. But for those who are interested in reading more about this issue, there's a book called Stolen Focus, which was published, I think, earlier this year or late last year. And it talks about the way in which social media and a lot of online communication platforms are designed to trigger conflict and to focus on posts or engagements that have a more negative response. So we know, even just from an amateur scientific point of view, that these things are designed to be hotbeds. This is the way that they work. But again, I'd go back to my initial point about digital literacy. The more that we understand this, the more that people are provided with access to education about what information looks like, the more secure and safe we're going to be in terms of minimizing the effects, because we're not going to be able to stop it is my perspective, but we can manage it. And so, for example, if you're from a community where you may not have had the same access to advanced education, a talking head on a YouTube video or whatever post your algorithm has turned up for you carries an element of authority that it actually shouldn't. And we've seen this in communities over a number of issues. Again, you know, not to labour the point, but during the lockdown around vaccines and pandemic public health management, there were very real concerns to be addressed there. I mentioned the issue of exercises of executive power and exercises of unelected power in Australia and balancing our federal system in doing that. There were very real issues to be had, but of course, the issues that stole the attention were less grounded in fact, so to speak. And so if we don't equip our communities with the skills to be able to distinguish information on digital platforms, then this will be a losing battle. But of course, the battle is not yet lost, and there's still an opportunity for us to take command of this. I do think that the tertiary sector, public sector, really all major industries in Australia do need to be thinking about this in a preventive, proactive way rather than merely waiting for it to happen and reacting. We all need cyber safety guidance, policies, training. But again, I'll just go back to that point of a national conversation about who we are, what we stand for, what our institutions do. Do we trust them? How do we trust? Why do we trust? And they are actually more powerful weapons than, for example, something that's simply operating on a digital platform to counter AI algorithms.
Climate change, disaster preparedness, and resilience have not traditionally been considered national security concerns, but a slew of catastrophic natural disasters over recent years has contributed to a change in this thinking. Mark Crossweller, Director of Ethical Intelligence and former Director General of Emergency Management Australia, is with me today to help explain how this affects policymaking. As a general question to start off with, how do the various parties' environmental policies impact Australia's national and energy security?
I think the biggest distinction is in environmental policies on climate change, yep. and I think that's well understood. It's difficult when you're working in public policy and as a public official for various governments of different persuasions, how you navigate the complexities of these policies. But yep. The first thing I say to people is that it's not that governments don't do anything. Yep. It's just the degree to which they respond to these challenges. And I think with conservative governments, we've seen what most would agree is a reasonably minimal response compared to the previous Labor government, for example. There's been a progressive realisation, I think, through bitter lived experience that climate is changing and the causes of climate change are now, generally speaking, accepted. And what triggered that was the devastating fire season 2 years ago, where I think it became a lived experience for many, many hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Australians.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think it sort of cast aside politically any seeds of doubt or remnant doubt about causation or its presence. So we're having a lived experience of that policy framework now. So I think 10 years previously, we could have done more clearly.
Yep.
In terms of anticipating for effect. I think we've been let down in terms of developing our anticipatory capacity, so our ability to get ahead of the game, to imagine what the future might look like with a climate-influenced set of hazards, to model those, to incorporate them in policy decisions and policy advice, to try and flavour the direction of society and the policies that attach in terms of where and how we place ourselves upon the landscape, for example.
Yeah, okay.
Could have been much better informed by a more robust, I think, a more rigorous approach to climate effects. Our capacity for adaptation is a long way behind where it could otherwise be. Our positioning for response is still lagging because we're still responding in the same way we've been responding for 50 years, 100 years or more. To these disasters, and clearly that hasn't worked in Lismore.
Yeah.
And it didn't really work in the fires a couple of years ago on the south coast of New South Wales particularly. So you can see that when we minimise these policy challenges, they do have material effects as time goes on. What does that mean for national security? Well, these are complex compounding and disasters and they're cascading as well, have cascading effects into our critical systems, into our infrastructure, into our economies, into our sociality, if you like, in society. So they don't just stop. The fire doesn't stop at the boundary gate. It doesn't stop with the house burning down. The effects are cumulative, cascading, and progressive.
Yep.
They're becoming more frequent. They're becoming more intense in most cases. And they're reverberating through many aspects of society that are nowhere near the fires or nowhere near the floods. It's causing a lot of unrest, uncertainty, doubt in the minds of some people about the ability for governments to cope with these impacts. That has a security implication in its own right. Mm. And then you can magnify that across, the rest of the world and what's happening with climate, with the mass migration of people, with the difficulties in food production, with the absence of water. And so it goes on. So these are all interlinked, interdependent.
Yep.
They all affect Australia in one way, shape or form. And it's good to see governments are trying to catch up or catching up with the policy questions, the policy challenges. I think that's a good thing. But so much more to do.
Are there any sort of stand-up policies on disaster resilience that you see within this election?
I think that, look, there's no specific policies that have arisen in my mind other than there's talk of the releasing of the $200 million a year for resilience funding out of the special fund that was set up for the purpose.
Yep.
The coalition government set it up. That was a great initiative. The $200 million a year is essentially The dividend from the investment on the capital. Mm-hmm. As I understand it, the government has released that money into the system now, and the Labor government is committed to doing the same thing. So that's about really the only policy commentary in the space of crisis management, at least in disasters and resilience. I think there's a general acceptance that the issue is still bipartisan.
Yeah.
I think there's an acceptance that the, for example, the disaster recovery funding arrangements, which is the key federal government policy document, to assist states and local governments in the recovery of disasters needs further review. Mm-hmm. The Royal Commission spoke about the Royal Commission into National Natural Disasters spoke about the need for further reform. I think both parties have committed to the continuation of the implementation of the recommendations of the Royal Commission. I think that needs to be accelerated.
Yeah, 100%.
And I think the implementation of the National Risk Reduction Framework, which is what the Resilience Task Force wrote for the government, which I was head of, it also needs an acceleration of the implementation of its recommendations and next stage of the implementation planning. So it's basically bipartisan.
Yep.
There's little difference really, because I think disasters should be bipartisan.
Yep.
They have been politicised of late for, you know, obviously there's election reasons that, you know, there are reasons why these things can spill over into a more political discourse. It's not to say they're not political. I think they are. We're talking about how you distribute equities of power, wealth and resource to protect people. That is the heart of politics, really.
Yeah.
You know, politics, when it does its job really well, and generally speaking, it does in disasters and crisis. So I think we are lucky in this country that overall we get through.
Yep.
And we get through with relatively minimal loss and suffering. It's still unacceptable what we go through, of course, but it could be a lot worse.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some wins on the board for everybody. But I think the climate is saying, and our lived experience is telling us, it's what we're doing now is just simply not enough. And we have to ramp it all up, but particularly where and how we place ourselves upon the landscape and the extent to which we absorb these forces into our societies. It can't just be a response solution.
Yep. We have seen the ADF playing a growing role in domestic disaster response and recovery missions. Is this sustainable? Are there any alternatives?
There's a lot of discussion about this. There's a couple schools of thought. I think the ADF is such an impressive outfit. Yep. In Australia. I mean, and you know, they're a ready force, and they're there to defend the nation. And it's not too difficult for people to extend that defence concept into natural hazards and threats and perils in the domestic context. But defence are not designed or set up for that, nor are they trained. And, you know, I used to say when I was Director General that you wouldn't put a firefighter onto a battleground.
Yeah.
So why would you put a soldier in the middle of a fire?
Yeah, 100%.
It just doesn't make sense. But look, I know the argument's a bit more complex than that. I think what it does signify is that there's a gap in capability that defence is trying to fill, and it's really why it's brought in to the state and territory responsibilities, is when there's a perception, at least, that there's a capability deficiency.
Mm-hmm.
Or capacity deficiency, the defence can fill it in the short term. But we're now talking about gaps that are far more significant than a defence force response.
Yep.
And I think that's what the recent disasters have showed us, that even a defence response is not enough to the effect of what's happening. And so there is this need to reconsider how we utilise existing resources, particularly emergency services, state emergency service, rural fire services, urban fire services, the extent to which they're properly coordinated across the country, the extent to which they can mobilise, the extent to which they're willing to do that work, of course, because much of the work is clean-up,
mm-hmm.
Initial relief and recovery work. Some of that is traditionally assigned to emergency services, some of it is not. Much of emergency services is volunteer, of course, and highly skilled and professional.
Yep.
The extent to which they're willing to step into this space is a question I think worth asking. I'm sure that generally speaking they would say yes.
Yep.
But we should give them due respect and due regard to answer that for themselves. But leaving all that aside, it's still not enough. And so we're seeing, in the absence of good policy on resilience, a good policy on risk reduction,
yep.
that we could have had 10 years ago, 15 years ago, if we'd taken up the climate challenges earlier, we probably wouldn't be facing what we're facing now. Now, that's not, it's no point sort of crying over spilled milk or days gone by. But it is to say, if we don't change now, that picture's only going to get worse, because we're at a start of a trajectory. What we're seeing now is not a new normal. It's the start of a trajectory in climate change, which these events will continue to intensify and increase in frequency.
Yep.
So it's not over yet, and it's not leveled. It hasn't leveled off yet. It will get worse
as climate change is becoming more prominent in the media and more prominent within our interconnected lives, and it's becoming a much more mainstream issue for Australian political parties and the government in general. Not just disaster resilience, but, you know, climate change and all of these interconnected sort of social aspects of it become traditional national security issues?
I was asked this question a couple of years ago. I think it's definitely a national security issue,
mm-hmm.
Because it goes to the heart of the degree to which citizens feel safe.
Yeah.
And you can't separate that sense of safety, you know, that nature might otherwise take away from the independent and interconnected systems for which we operate and live in. And they can be threatened by cyber or, you know, by terrorism or by warfare or all sorts of things. So I think you have to look at it as a total package of security. So I think for that perspective, it's important not to separate out.
Yeah.
National security tends to be politically more prominent, I think, but traditionally it's been a more prominent issue.
Mm-hmm.
But some would argue, some academics would argue and some commentators would argue that climate is a much bigger issue than anything that a terrorist could cause or anything that even a single nation could cause, because yep. climate is truly a global common and it's having an effect on the global community. There's not a corner of the world that it isn't affecting in some way, shape or form. So for that reason alone, whether you separate it out from national security or not, it just simply cannot be ignored. My view is it is absolutely a national security issue because mm-hmm. it has global reach and it has the potential to upset the global order.
Yeah.
And create enormous amounts of geopolitical instability. So I think it's fair and square in the middle of the national security debate and the national security definition. As I said, we're at the start of a trajectory of effect.
Mm-hmm.
And we cannot continue to watch people go through the suffering that the people in Lismore or Brisbane or, you know, right down the east coast of New South Wales, essentially starting from southeast Queensland and moving all the way down. As recently as 3 months ago, I've gone through a terrible set of circumstances. We don't want to see that if we can and do anything we can to avoid it. I mean, you know, one of the prime responsibilities of a government, of a Western liberal democracy at least, is to, you know, to have a general duty of care, you know, a moral duty of care or a political duty of care to help people find their happiness,
yeah,
to be well mm-hmm. and to flourish.
Yeah, no, 100%.
And that's a personal responsibility, of course, as well, but it's also an obligation of a government to facilitate that wherever it's possible to do so. And while that's really complex about how you balance up the priorities and the equities that attach is, you know, that's just pure politics, really. And it can be really exciting as well, but we just should never forget that's what we're trying to achieve here as humans is what we're trying to achieve. We're trying to find our happiness. We're trying to be well and stay well, and mm-hmm. we're trying to flourish and maximize the opportunity to be human.
Yeah.
We should never forget that. And whatever we do in public policy should contribute towards that, manage the harmfulness along the way, manage the inequities and the mistakes and the errors and all the things that come with it, but just mm-hmm. don't ever forget the central tenet. That those three things are what we're all trying to achieve. And I think if we keep our minds, you know, at least put that in the back of our minds, but keep it sharp and focused, we will actually make different decisions and better decisions over time.
As the election creeps closer, national security remains front and centre. We hope this episode has helped articulate the policies on offer. And thanks to all of our guests. If you have any feedback, we'd love for you to get in touch with us at natsecpod@anu.edu.au. And before we go, don't forget to check out our national security election snapshots. We've linked to them in the show notes. Now go get your democracy sausage on the 21st.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.